Hello, and welcome to How to Make a Memory, the show that explores the items that we make for one another and how they impact our relationships. My name is Jen Tierney, and this week I'm joined by my friend Gabe, who's spent the past several years living out in Seattle. This is an important detail because it was this move across the country that was the catalyst for what he's made. Gabe makes games, specifically role-playing games. Our love of games is something that we have in common and helped me to become part of the close-knit community of friends that adopted me when Joe and I began dating. Gabe and my husband have been friends for most of their lives, and sharing his story fills me with so much joy. I hope to raise my children with the kind of love for games and community that Gabe embodies.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Gabe. How are you?
Oh, wow. You're like, hold on one second. I'm very well.
Okay. Do I sound weird?
You do sound weird. Not in a bad way.
Okay. I should sound a little bit weird because I do have a little bit of a cold.
I think it's made you like, you sound, yeah, like a different person, I guess.
A different person.
Yeah. Like,
Sultry,
yeah.
Perfect.
It's good, though. I don't know. People with colds sound so serious. And
yes.
like I don't know.
All right. So the standard opening question on this podcast is, Gabe, tell me about what it is that you make.
I make games, I guess. When I was a very young teenager, like 11 or 12, we mostly played games. And then over time, that turned into making games. A lot of them are just Dungeons & Dragons, which is a really pleasant way to waste time. But we've branched out into computer games and at different times, live action role playing, although I would like to talk about that as little as possible. Yeah, I don't know. I've probably played games with just people that I've met along the way, certainly dozens and dozens of people, as a way to just hang out, essentially, or to keep up with distant friends, or to, like, as an excuse to see people on a weekly basis.
So as an 11 or 12 year old in the 90s, as so many people, including myself and my brothers, were drawn to games like Magic and Dungeons and Dragons and things like that, do you think it's the format of Dungeons and Dragons itself that then lent itself to you going on to create things on your own? Or was it something else that made you think, I want to create my own worlds and storylines?
Yes to both of those, because older versions of Dungeons & Dragons especially lent themselves very well to do-it-yourself campaign worlds, making your own rule books and so on, because the rules were not really play-tested. The production values weren't actually that high. So you could easily make something that was superior to what you could buy at the store. Whereas, for example, if you went out now and bought D&D 5th edition, the production values are through the roof, everything's balanced, everything's playtested. So I think there's less need to create stuff on your own now. And as for the other part, a lot of people become gamers out of a frustrated urge to be a fantasy writer. And I think that I was that when I was about 12. And eventually I moved from that to being a frustrated game designer to being a frustrated programmer. A lot of people have turned, I mean, like George R. R. Martin has absolutely played so much D&D.
Yeah.
As we can see, that's turned into something fantastic.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is your favorite thing that you've made? Your favorite game or your favorite, I mean, even if it isn't a game?
Oftentimes, when you're designing something like this, it's halfway between an improv session and a board game, I guess. It's like squarely between there. You're your own audience. It's a participatory medium. And you can either land or crash, I guess. And the most successful thing is clearly this Levia game that I'm running right now, which is collaborative online strategy role-playing experience for seven of my very best friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't really taken it to the masses here, and I think that would kind of not be the point.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of making art for few people. But so in this particular game, it's a strategy game where people control a country, a fantastical country that they have designed, which has its own unique attributes, and they've been jockeying for power with each other for probably 2 years now.
Yeah, it's about 2 years.
I don't know if that's the longest running game I've ever run, but it's certainly up there. And it's interesting because it's like a side project to all of our lives in a way. Like when the people involved, who are all over the country at this point, see each other once in a blue moon, we say the usual things like, how are you? How are the kids? But then we also say, and what do you have planned for the region of Sagastigori in the coming year? And, you know, we scheme and we betray each other, and it's a lot of fun.
So as sort of like an innocent bystander to all of this, because obviously my husband has been a part of the campaign for these 2 years, and I think I remember in the past that it had tried to get going a few times and it just hadn't taken root. And then this time it worked, and Joe just like jumped in and was really, really enamored by the storyline and by how the dynamics between everyone worked. And he was so happy to have an opportunity to talk to everyone frequently. And I think that was like the real sticking point for him was, here's this thing I get to do with my friends all the time. And for me, I was so glad that it existed, because now here's a game that he can play with people that he knows and cares about, and not, you know, strangers online who he doesn't know at all. And so to me, it felt like much more of an investment in friendship, because to me, relationships are the most important things.
Online play is not as magical as playing in real life.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's always magical to play in real life, especially mm-hmm. if they're strangers, but like, I think fundamentally it's best done, any kind of game, but mm-hmm. role-playing games in particular are best done with your friends, because it's not, I would 1,000 times rather play with people who've never played a game before than with random gamers that I met. I don't mean any offense to random gamers. I just think part of the magic is interacting with the personalities that you know in a slightly different context. It's like poker in a way, where the entertainment is in your reaction to the game in a way.
Yeah. There was this period of time about a year ago, maybe a little bit longer ago than that now, when I don't remember the exact scenario, because I've heard so many different Levia stories over the last 2 years that it's hard to remember which ones were which, because there's just been so many different storylines and so many betrayals and partnerships and allegiances. And I remember at one point in time, there was this almost malicious conflict between Joe and Will. And Joe would just talk about it. And I really, there was a period of time when I kind of became a little stressed out, because Will is like a teddy bear of a human being.
A darling.
He's a sweet, charming, lovely, like gives the best hugs in the world. And my husband is also.
And so handsome.
Yes, he's so handsome too. And Joe is also a very kind, warm person. As long as I've known both of them, they've only been kind and generous and sweet with one another. And I just couldn't wrap my head around the language that I was hearing around their interactions because of Levia. And I was just like, I don't understand. And then we were going to be seeing Will, and I'd heard all these like negative things about Will for like weeks. And and because I didn't realize that there was such an incredibly profound separation between friendship and the game, I did not understand that, because that part of it wasn't available to me. That wasn't visible to me. I was just hearing Joe complain about the game and what was going on and how he was going to like stick it to Will in the next turn. And like, it's going to be so awkward to see Will. They just like ran at each other and like hugged and were so happy to see each other. And then they were like, okay, now we can't talk at all about Levy. Okay. I don't understand, but I'll try. And over the last year or so, I've really come to realize that it's like this alternative life for everyone, and then everyone's super invested in it, and it's become sort of a foundation for your friendships because everyone does live so super far away. And I think that there's this wonderful thing about seeing people you haven't seen in a long time, where the very best friends, you can see them and it's like no time has passed since the last time you saw them. And I think that even though I don't play Levia, I somehow feel still so much more connected to all of you from hearing about it and from Joe's experience with it, that I think it just boosts in this really incredible way that phenomenon of, I feel like I just saw you yesterday. I haven't seen you in like a year.
True.
But I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I just saw you. you know, because I still have
a current of communication between all of
yeah.
us. Yeah. It's kind of my love letter to all of my friends.
Oh.
Like my continual production of games.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
This one's interesting because it lets, I think part of the difference between Joe and Will was not just strategic, like it made sense for them to attack each other, but also a conflict of worldviews and strategies for problem solving. Joe, for example, is more data driven, I think,
Oh, yeah.
and a very real politique, whereas Will is very much, he attempts to find an equitable solution, I think. Whereas Joe's playing for keeps, which is fine in a game, you know, it's not poker. He's not like winning Will's car in a hand of poker. It's just ones and zeros.
Yeah.
So I think that made it a little bit more bitter. Also the long-running nature of the game, because it's been 2 years, and for all I know, it will be another 2 years.
Let's hope.
No, let's not hope. I could be doing other games.
Are you sort of feeling like Levia's time is coming to an end so you can explore something else?
Well, something interesting about this game in particular is that if I get tired of the way things are going, I can change
Yeah.
things radically to the point where maybe it is almost a different game. And if I do it really well, the people playing won't even recognize that I did that. Yeah, I want maybe some more narrative and dramatic elements so that there's sort of more of a story arc instead of just emergent gameplay, which is like where things happen because of how players react to each other instead of part of the game inherently. So I think I'm going to incorporate more of that. We'll see.
Yeah. I really enjoyed back when Joe, maybe it was when Joe was declaring war on Will, he made that video.
That was
It
fantastic.
was great because Joe, until quite recently, he hasn't historically made a whole lot of like physical things. Like the joy that he gets in life doesn't come from like the creation of physical things as much as sitting down and thinking through numbers and being tactical and being strategic. Like that's where his real joy comes from. So when I saw him create that video, it gave me an opportunity to really relate to that and connect to him because that's the kind of stuff I like to do. I like to create things that people can experience. And so I was like, oh, this is great. I hope you have to do things like this for Levia all the time.
I'd like to encourage it. The more content, the better, for sure.
So to change the subject a little bit, what have you taught someone to make that you're really proud of?
I suppose mostly I teach vocabulary, great words like trebuchet and arbalest. That's, I think, the main positive effect of playing role-playing games. Also, I think when we were much younger, you know, late elementary school, it's a really good way for people who are shy to kind of realize that they don't have to be. And I think that some of the people that we've played with over the years who otherwise might really have just lived more wrapped up inside of themselves were drawn out because of the nature of the game and the way that it forces you to continually interact in a pleasant way that you don't even realize you're doing it. And it's actually not that far of a leap from pretending to be an assertive nobleman or whatever to being an assertive person trying to get what you want at the DMV or whatever. I'm not going to name names, but I think some people have been very helped by the socialization, I guess.
That's one of the first things I really noticed when I met everyone, like 12 years ago, 13 years ago, is that I was really surprised by how sociable everyone was. Because I walked into a room where everyone was playing Magic the Gathering, and my historic experience with walking into rooms where everyone was playing Magic the Gathering was that they would not be sociable, you know? Like I had some, you know, experience that had given me some preconceived notions about, you know, what that would be like. And as my, you know, experience has grown over time, I have learned that totally sociable people exist within the gaming communities, but it wasn't something I was used to. And I think that really comes from playing role-playing games is it really helps people gain a lot of really useful world skills, especially when it comes to
how we relate to other people and how we negotiate relationships and things like that.
It's interesting because I think, I don't want to slam on magic too much, but it definitely does not test the same skill set. And it's like comparing playing chess and having a conversation effectively. In one case, you're trying to think as methodically and like a computer as much as you can. And in the other, you're rewarded by lateral problem solving, by the ability to be winsome, to get what you want with suasion rather than with raw thinking. It's interesting that we kind of live in an era where games are more of a thing culturally. Like, it's not the 80s where people think that you're building an altar to Baphomet because you roll some funny-sided dice once a week. And it's not the 90s where you're going to get your books dumped or whatever for pretending to be an elf sometimes. But, I mean, it's like retro and cool, and a lot of people who have never played Dungeons and Dragons hear about it and really want to, who otherwise would have no connection. And like, you see it in Stranger Things, and I'm sure they're going to revive the D&D IP as a movie at some point.
You had said, let's not talk about LARPs.
Oh, we can talk about it. I just was...
Well, it's just my only real experience personally playing a game that you created. So, because I think other than that one LARP, I don't think I've played anything.
What LARP did you play in?
I played in the one where everyone was actually dead, but they didn't know they were dead.
Could you narrow it down?
Was that a theme for you?
Well, so there was one where one that I ran written by, I think his name was Scott Baker, who is some sort of professor in Australia, that was sort of based on Twin Peaks.
Okay.
And some of the people were dead and some of the people were alive.
That might have been it. It was in like a loft above somebody's garage.
Oh, yeah. The one where it was, I forget what it was called, but it was Christmas Eve in hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nobody knew that they were dead. Everybody ostensibly had a weapon or some items or whatever. And everybody had like a motivation and like a goal. And I remember thinking, oh, Gabe gave me a gun. Everyone must have a gun or something better than a gun. I should not use this because then I will be killed. So I remember spending the whole game like infuriating you because you just wanted me to use the gun so everybody would realize that they were dead, because it was like a plot point. And I was just like not interested in shooting anyone. And like, I think you kept on like manifesting conflicts that would make me want to shoot people.
I think that my probable frustration at that kind of thing is equally valuable to whatever story might have occurred. I'm not sad about that. So in an era now where everyone uses Google Documents, it's very normal. But we had just gotten a piece of software that I think was called SubEtha Edit, which might have eventually been bought by Google, that allowed multiple people to edit the same text document. So I'm trying to remember. I think Tim, Zach, and myself locked ourselves in a room for a weekend while editing the same thing and wrote furiously and probably went through quite a bit of PBR and came up with that.
Yeah, I remember that was the exact scenario. It also, at that time, because of my early relationship with Joe, it felt almost like this rite of initiation. I'd arrived, like, here I am, I've shown up, I've been given a character, don't screw this up, Jen, you gotta bring your A game. And it was great. It sort of ushered me into like a totally new phase of my relationships with everyone individually, but also with Joe, in that I no longer felt like this piece of baggage that was being carried along to things. I felt like my own separate, unique person who was there and had value and had their own things to bring. And, you know, I think that that made a really big difference for me. So thanks, Gabe.
You're welcome. We do what we can. which apparently is Haze people's significant others. Glad to be of service.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit part of it. But I think that you kind of have to, you know? You guys are so close that, I mean, only the best will do, I feel like, is sort of like this unspoken mantra. You know, we have to make sure this one's good. I think that that can be really useful. I found that to be very, like, these people really care about him and they want what's best for him. And I also want what's best for him. So this will work out. I just need to sort of jump through some hoops. It'll be okay. But I think that it was, in hindsight, very sweet. It wasn't so sweet when I was going through it, but that's okay.
It is interesting. I don't know if you have any theatrical background, but
a little bit.
You're not the first person to have essentially gone through that same situation. And for a lot of people, it can be very awkward to be essentially thrust into a situation where they have to act and have no experience doing it. And also to be making up your own script. I mean, that's improvisation generally, but not everybody is familiar with it. I'm sure you did fine.
Yeah, I did okay. It wasn't the best thing I've ever done, but I think that part of the thing that was enjoyable for me was sort of observing everybody else. I tend to generally be a little bit more of a bystander and an observer, or at least at that time in my life when it came to role-playing games, because I liked to, you know, get a feel for how people were. For me, it was very fulfilling. I enjoyed it a lot. But I can see how that would be incredibly stressful for some people. Because I used to do a lot of improv in high school, and I always did, you know, the fall play, the spring musical, all that stuff. So for me, I was like, yay, this is great. I haven't done this in years.
Something interesting in a similar interpersonal vein is one of the people in Levia had only met some of the other people briefly and years prior.
Yeah. Yep.
So the only actual experience that this one person had with the other really was through the game.
Yeah. Is this Adam?
And this is Adam, yeah.
Yeah, yep.
Like, he had never met Sean or anything, really. In that circumstance, and I think if when you were at this LARP and talking to other people that maybe you hadn't met before?
Yeah, there were definitely people there I hadn't met before.
So you have to sort of accept them as their character, and I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah, it gives you a very complicated perspective on who a person might be.
Yes.
Especially in a game where, like, everyone was so super evil.
I played in a game that went on for, I think, it was like a, you know, once a month type thing for about a year out in somewhere in Vermont, actually. And my character, I had decided, speaks like the boss in Office Space, you know, like a,
that's so funny.
Yeah, I'd like the DPP reports or whatever. And I can't even do it. It's been so long. But like, eventually I went to a party with a bunch of the people there and they were like, you don't have a weird voice at all. And I was like, what do you mean? And they all thought that my voice was actually the Office Space boss voice because I stayed in character so much.
Oh my goodness. That's great.
great and probably too bad. But that's not how I want to be remembered.
Yes. Yeah, legacy is important.
Luckily, we have this podcast to set the record.
That's right. That's right. Everyone will now know what you really, truly sound like.
I think there's something very special about making anything, in my case, games, but in a broader sense, really anything, for a small number of people rather than doing something for a mass audience, be it mass media or like just the difference between a scarf made by a good friend or family member versus compared to a scarf that you got at Target or whatever. I think that there's something really important about making things for each other that is special in a way that our society sometimes forgets to be. And I love doing that with my friends and for my friends.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. That is so much of my motivation for just about everything, including this podcast.
You're very industrious. This podcast is a good idea.
Thank you very much. I find that I always need to have like a couple projects going, and this seems like a good long-term project.
It's interesting in a way. It's like my game that I have because it gives you an excuse to talk to people that you haven't spoken to since last year or whatever. It lets you ask questions that maybe you wouldn't normally be able to do, and it makes content probably mostly of interest to people you already know. So it's like, I don't know, during the Victorian era, people used to have plays in their own houses, which is kind of silly, but it's like that. It's more special because it's not intended for everybody.
Yeah. Yep.
And I'm
Exactly.
not saying that your podcast won't become a, hit
I
success. You'll
think it's highly unlikely.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I think that's okay. I think that the
You just
only
need to land some
people,
big names.
that's right. I just need to, like book, I don't know, the McElroy brothers and some other big podcasters, and then I'll be set. I've said this a couple of times now that I really am just mostly making this for my two kids. Like, I really just want them to have something to listen to. And my friends and my family, I want to be able to sort of like, if somebody tells me their story, it's just a, like two people having a conversation. But if I can share that story with more people in my circle, and maybe, like there are people who will listen to this who know you, but maybe there's something that you've said that they didn't know about you before. So now they've sort of had this conversation with you, because podcasting can be really like all at once, it is intimate, but it is also public. And I think that that's the nice balance that I like about it, that it allows me to sort of help these stories that are meaningful to spread out a little bit further.
It's kind of interesting that you, like, most of my ancestors, to my knowledge, have not written books, for example.
Yep.
And so I know very little about them, except for the few stories that have filtered down. And very plausibly, I think your descendants could listen to this podcast 100 years from now or 200 years from now and be like, what a sweet lady.
What a sweet lady who had such a terrible cold.
Well, yes, they had colds back then, they'll say. But it's interesting that you're creating something at once more ephemeral because it's digital and less ephemeral because things that are created digitally seem poised to remain, if not forever, for the foreseeable future. So it's like you've made something that, I don't know, it's contact with eternity in a way.
I feel very, very much comforted by that idea. This idea of I may be allowing myself in some way to outlive myself, which is so comforting.
And yet, maybe not comforting at all.
Before this conversation, I hadn't spoken with Gabe for about a year. He made a point as he spoke that made me even more grateful for this project. In doing this podcast, I'm giving myself the opportunity to have these super enjoyable conversations with friends and family. You are all helping me to create something special, and I think that's something for all of us to be proud of. That being said, if you have a story that you would like to share, please send me an email at howtomakeamemory@gmail.com. Tell me about something you've made, something that's been made for you, or something you were taught to make. Tell me about how the act of making has impacted your relationships with the people you care about. I'd be honored to hear your story and maybe even share it here on the podcast. And now I'd like to tell you about something I made this week. By the time you hear this episode, I will hopefully have wrapped up the creation of a wedding gift for some very close friends of mine. They were married last November, so I'm nearing the 1 year mark. I've spent around 80 hours knitting them a deep green cabled throw. I'm going to be seeing them this weekend at another wedding and want to deliver it in person since they live several hours away. As of this moment, I still have two balls of yarn to go, so I'd better get going. One last special announcement. This week, my brother Chuck, who wrote our music, is celebrating a big milestone. His band, Amigos Amigos, has released their most recent album called Music Box.
I've listened to it several times and absolutely love it. You can find it on CD Baby, and I'll include a link in the show notes. Congratulations, Chuck! Well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. A special thank you to Gabe for joining me and giving me even more reasons to love this project. Our music is by Chuck Salamone. Our logo is by Becky Carpenter. We get system admin support from Greg Thole. Now, go make something for someone you love.